Welcome to the For the Church podcast, another great gospel-centered resource from Midwestern Baptist Theological Seminary. My name is Jared Wilson. I'm an assistant professor of pastoral ministry and author in residence at Midwestern Seminary. And I'm here as always with my friend and my colleague and my co-host who has dug himself out of the barricade of snow, Ross Ferguson.
Yeah, there's been a lot of snow.
We've had a snowpocalypse or a snowmageddon. I don't know what we want to call it.
What do you call it if it's more ice than more snow? Then snow that becomes ice.
Yeah, it's like a layer cake.
I don't know what that is.
A layer cake of snow. Yeah, we got ice. I mean, this was a month ago from when we're recording.
But we're still digging
it. It was 3 days ago from from when we're recording this. Yeah, when you get the ice and then the snow, that's actually kind of okay because snow on top gives you a little traction.
Yeah.
If it's just ice, that's the worst.
Yeah, I had to drive out on the ice and I can say that
You were doing like rescue missions.
Yeah. I don't know what it is, but people text Scottish people to go and rescue them in the ice. They have this assumption, you know, Scotland gets ice. It doesn't really.
I've never made that equation. No. I don't know. I think people just know that you'll help, so they call you. And
that's true.
You should be encouraged by that.
What I do get a lot, which I still can't believe I get this 3 years after moving here, is things like this. Do you get hail in Scotland? Do you get snow in Scotland? Do you get this type of ice in Scotland?
Yeah.
Does the sun shine in Scotland? Is there clouds in Scotland?
Is there weather? Is there weather? Climate? Are you on the globe?
And the answer to all of these is yes. But yeah, we still get that question. I got that this morning, just walking up the hill to do the podcast. Someone said, does it get this cold in Scotland? Like, I've been here 3 years.
I don't know.
No, it doesn't.
Okay. Well, you just said it does get snow and hail and ice, but now you're saying it doesn't. Well, I don't understand what you're saying. People are wanting to know more about your country.
Honestly,
don't bother Ross about his homeland.
Honestly, I just make it up on the spot and just to have a laugh now. I'm at the point where I just like don't trust anything I say about Scotland.
Yeah, we have volcano season.
Yeah,
you can kind of make stuff up like that. No, it's so bad, actually. We haven't gotten mail all week.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I was like, on day three, I was like, oh, maybe they're just delayed. So I started actually looking up, like, what's the deal with our mail? And it turns out the local mail is blaming it on the KC Center, the clearinghouse, where they haven't gotten the mail from them.
Yeah.
So I can see, like, you know, you can log in to your, if you make an account on the US mail webpage. It's called informed delivery.
I do
that, especially when I'm traveling to see like, if certain things are coming in or not. And I'm like, I'm getting mail, but they're not actually delivering it. And so I'm really tired. And today they're not delivering it or tomorrow they're not delivering it. No, today they're not delivering it because of Jimmy Carter's memorial service or something like that. So it's going to be like a week without mail, which is, you know.
I like going to the mailbox and seeing what's there.
Yeah, it's like a little gift, except when it's junk. You get there and it's just junk or something.
Yeah.
But sometimes you get little cards and letters, and sometimes you get checks, you know, people owe you money. And like, that's usually what I'm going to
sometimes
mail for.
Sometimes you get bills.
Well, you get bills. That's true.
If you ever want to talk about beef, it's me and the US Postal Service.
Oh, okay.
Just compared to the Royal Mail in Scotland and the UK, the US Postal Service is just junk. It's just not good in any. I don't know if I'm allowed to say that on a podcast, but I've said it. It's just every time we get something from the UK, it's trashed by the time it gets here. We have letters that are ripped in half.
How do you know it's trashed on this end?
I'm just going to blame it this end.
It'd be cool to like put like a camera following that package on its overseas voyage.
That's the other thing. How expensive it is to deliver anything here. Anything.
Oh, yeah.
I was laughing with my mother who was visiting us just a few weeks ago. She was here for a month and we had delivered to her like 2.5 years ago. She really likes pretzel M&Ms. So we delivered her some pretzel M&Ms for the church mug and all this sort of stuff.
Yeah.
It cost us like $40 or something crazy to send. Never appeared. And it didn't even get on the plane. So somewhere between Kansas City and the plane, it disappeared.
So you could track it.
You could track it and it just disappeared.
Stop.
Yep. Someone opened it up and is drinking. If you are in an airport drinking For the Church from a For the Church mug and you don't know where it came from, that's my mug.
You know, I can top that. It's actually worse. That's what I mean by topping it. we shipped from Houston once our girls' Christmas presents
because
we didn't have room,
mm-hmm.
and we shipped them all from Houston. Did not arrive.
No,
they like disappeared as well, and we could track them.
Yeah.
To say like, oh, it was this shipping facility that these things are gone. So we like called and everything, but you know, we have a grandmother with means, and she replaced them all basically. But. Yeah. That was like, you're stealing the kids' Christmas presents. Yeah. This is like the Grinch post office, you know?
Oh, Christmas, I'll tell you what. I had a story on Christmas.
Okay.
So Leah, which is my eldest daughter, really wanted a pair of Doc Martens. And she really wanted a blue velvet pair of Doc Martens.
Oh, yeah, you told me about this.
Yeah, and it turns out they no longer make them. So I'm searching every website weeks in advance of Christmas, can't find them anywhere. Finally find a pair online, from a secondhand retailer, but they're brand new. Finally order them. I send them a message like, can you get this in time for Christmas? This is my daughter's main gift. We're really excited to be able to get this for her because we didn't think we'd get it. Get a message back. No problem. I'll get it to you. I'll send it. Immediate delivery. So we're waiting on tenterhooks thinking, oh, I really hope this arrives because like this is basically her main gift. It arrives and I open it up and I think, these look amazing. She's going to be so impressed by them. And then I pause and I think, these look really big. And I check the sizes. She's a size 8. First size 8, fantastic. Second size 10. They've sent me two different sizes.
What in the world?
So I immediately get on my phone. This is 4 days before Christmas. Immediately go on my phone, send the retailer a message. They come back saying, yep, sorry, that was our mistake. We'll refund you. And it's like, well, do you have another size in? Obviously, you've sent me two sizes. Surely you can send me, no, we can't do refunds. We can't send them back. So I'm like, well, do you have a size 7? She might be able to squeeze into a 7. They're like, yep, we could send you a 7. Can it get in time for Christmas? Yeah, I'll put it in delivery. So then you know, a size 7 is coming our way, but we're going to someone else's for Christmas. So the size 7 is then on to the way to the house of this other person while I deliver back the wrong one.
Okay.
But then I have a slight panic along the lines of, she's not going to have anything to open on Christmas Day. So then I go, okay, let's order a different set on Amazon and have that delivered as a size 8. Oh no, as a size 7, and at least she'll have a pair, and then she can make a decision. We can return it. Well, that pair arrives, but the blue velvet pair doesn't arrive.
Oh.
So on Christmas Day, she opens up the one that was like the second option.
Yeah, yeah.
She tries it on; it doesn't fit.
Oh no,
size 7s don't fit, and we have these blue velvet size 7s
coming,
and I'm like, oh, what do I do now? So I'm now on my, like, I've bought a pair, sent it back. I've bought a pair that I'm waiting for delivery. I've bought a pair and it doesn't fit her. So on Christmas Day, I'm searching for a size 8 of a version she likes, and I finally find a size 8 and I order that. So I'm like, I'm on my fourth pair now. Then on the Christmas Day night, I get a message from the person, which is the fourth pair, to tell me, oh, by the way, I put the wrong size online. It's actually a size 7. I'm not going to send it. So I'm like, I'm just going spare now. I've done 4 separate pairs of boots.
What in the world?
Well, the next day we go to the USPS and get the size 7 blue velvet that finally arrive. Leah puts them on. They're a little bit snug, but they fit perfectly.
Wow.
So she's super happy. I'm driving home feeling like I've lost 10 years of my life after going through
these
4
boots.
Separate pair of boots. And all I said to Leah is, you know that I love you because I went through, I think, the jingle all the way experience I have went through every retailer. It's like, if you don't like these boots, like I give up. I don't know what to do.
It's kind of like in the 80s, the Cabbage Patch adult. They're just trying to find that perfect.
But I got a refund. I ended up getting a refund for everything. So it was a very tight financial Christmas after four
pairs of boots, velvet boots.
But I got all that back. So anyway, that was my Christmas experience.
Yeah. You know, the other girls could wear them. You can just have a little band or something. You got velvet boot band, the Ferguson velvet boot band. Well, speaking of snow drifts, we're talking about drift today.
Oh, there we go.
You know, we got drifting snow.
Mm-hmm.
We've got drifting gospel. I thought we would start by talking a little bit about the concept of gospel amnesia, the phenomenon of gospel amnesia. I was thinking about this recently, you know, conducting membership interviews, and it has struck me, and we've, you know, discussed it as elders, what we can do about it, that there are those who, they affirm the true gospel when they hear it. We have good reason to believe that they are Christians. They come from another church where they've been affirmed as a member. they attend a six-week membership course in which they hear the gospel rehearsed. And then when you sit down and you ask them, what is the gospel? And they struggle to answer the question. And this is not, I mean, this is a phenomenon I've experienced going back multiple churches. And I've been trying to figure out what it is that when you say, do you believe Jesus died for your sins? Oh, yeah, of course. Yeah. You know? But when someone's just asked the question, what is the gospel? Why they struggle with it so much? And we have, I think, a natural forgetfulness to it. Do you agree with that? Do you think, what's the root of that?
Yeah, I do agree with that. I think the other response you'll get is either a struggle to articulate it, or they'll articulate it in what seems like trite answers, as in what they've heard, as in they'll go through, like, here's point one, two, three, and four. And as they say it, you can think, you've heard that from somewhere. It's not that that's coming from within you. It's it's a repetition of something you've read or heard, but it doesn't necessarily have deep meaning. I think people forget, because I think quite often we treat the gospel academically. It's something that is something that we need to mind know, and we can believe in something in our mind and think, yeah, I that computes to me. I think that's true. But does it actually go to the depth of our heart? Does it mean something to how we live, how we think, how we behave, how we feel? And I think that's sometimes a disconnect, is that you can believe something academically, but can you actually believe in that? I'm just thinking of Jonah and the people in Nineveh. It says they believed God, they believed Jonah, they believed academically, if you will, that this is going to happen. And then 100 years later, Nineveh's completely destroyed in their unbelief. And it's because it hasn't necessarily deep-seated in. And I wonder if that's the case within the church. We have academic knowledge. We've heard the sermons. We know the answers. It's like the silly Sunday school answer. Jesus, like we know the answer, but do we actually know it?
Yeah.
I think that's probably where we're getting some issues.
Yeah, you know, holding the gospel as an abstraction or as just sort of a idea. It kind of hangs in the air in this sort of vacuum. It doesn't have the everyday resonance. And especially when we can't speak of, so, I mean, in my experience, I don't know about yours, but those who were saved, you know, outside of a church experience tend to have, this isn't 100%, but they tend to have a greater grasp because they know the before and after that they, you know, didn't have the sort of vocabulary, and then they heard the good news and they believed. They tend to have a better sort of grasp. I think when you have a stronger sense of the impact on your life of this good news, you know, the more it resonates with you and the more it seems to stick. And so, again, I'm not saying that those who struggle with the question are unbelievers. I mean, sometimes they are, you know, they are unbelievers. I just think we have a gospel amnesia. And I think this gospel amnesia, or this, you know, this tendency to drift is in the flesh. I think it's something that's somehow in our fallen DNA. And I think it's affected the church by and large. And we've talked before about kind of what happened to the gospel-centered movement. You know, we've talked on this podcast about it. You and I've talked with Ed Stetzer in a previous episode about it, and maybe even Tim Challies. There's been some, you know, a lot of conversation about that. But I have a new book coming out. It actually comes out tomorrow. It comes out February 4th. So it came out yesterday. it came out yesterday. It's called Lest We Drift, 5 Departure Dangers from Gospel Centrality. And the premise of the book derives from Hebrews chapter 2, verse 1. Therefore, we must pay much closer attention to what we have heard, lest we drift away from it. And so the idea is, like, there are things that tempt us or distract us from the centrality of the gospel, the import of the gospel in our lives. And they have, you know, they wreak havoc, not just on us individually, you know, spiritually, but on the church. And so as we try to troubleshoot, hey, what happened to the gospel-centered thing? And, you know, I'm not as preoccupied with, say, you know, the movement, but the impact of the movement. It seems like people have moved on. I feel like we have a gospel amnesia. And I was laughing yesterday. I won't name the name, but I was, you know, scrolling through Twitter, as one does when you're just frittering time away. And there's a person who was upset with another person and was saying, you know, you just need to preach Jesus and the gospel. If we could just get back to that. And this person who was making the complaint is someone who has drifted away from preaching Jesus and the gospel for like the last 5 years. Yeah. And I thought, oh, or like, are you coming back to it? Or is it now, this is just sort of the, you know, the bludgeon you use on your ideological enemies. And I thought, man, you know, physician, heal thyself, you know, kind of thing. It happens to us and we don't even know that it's happening to us. So that's why it's called drift, I think. And so the author of Hebrews is saying we have to pay close attention to this or we're going to drift away. How does drift happen, do you think, like in church contexts?
I mean, I saw an advertisement on another social media platform, which I think answers this question. And it was most preaching that has been taught in seminaries and in books, it comes from the 1950s. That no longer connects anymore. We need to modernize our approach. And we're seeing this in terms of this world of AI. We're seeing it in terms of attractional, how do we attract people out of this world to the church? And what we think is needed is different approaches. We need a different style of preaching. We need a dynamism in the pulpit. We need church buildings that are modern. We need to be able to attract the young people with concerts. We need to do things to make the message, if you will, attractive. And what we'll say is, oh, we won't change the message. It'll still be about Jesus, but we need to add all these kind of paraphernalias on top of it to make sure that people will actually hear that message. And I think that's one of the biggest issues, I think, today is the message might be the same. I'm going to give it a, you know, benefit of a doubt, but the packaging is completely different now. And the packaging is all about enticement. It isn't about, you know, a God that loves you and a need to repent from our sin. It's about, isn't church cool? This is the place to be. If you're wandering, this is the place to be because we've got this, we've got that, we've got this. And I saw just even a few months ago at Christmas, it wasn't things like, let's come and celebrate Jesus in this concert. It's, this is the hit latest concert that you want to be able to find. So I think that's part of the issue is that we are trying to, I don't even necessarily want to say be attractional churches. That's not necessarily even what I'm trying to say. I guess we're just trying to package it in such a way that actually our focus goes off the message and onto the packaging. And how, if the packaging's right, that will entice people. And actually what you find is people are not really interested in what's at the core of that package because you're still letting them unwrap the package. They're still doing all of the extras, but not actually delving deep. And again, that leads into the why they can't really explain the gospel because they're just kind of hearing it as part of the packaging, but they haven't had it challenged right to their core. And I don't know, maybe that's part of the simple church model of trying to get rid of all of that packaging and just saying, this is what we're about, like our lumpet type thing, rather than here's all the extras.
Yeah, institutionally and organizationally, I've thought about, okay, how did, you know, there's one way to talk about this just in terms of movements and in terms of sort of cultural manifestations of, right, the gospel-centered thing, the young restless reform, conservative, you know, gospel-centered resurgence, and the kind of organizations that grew up around that or flourished, right? So things like Crossway, you know, publishers and so forth. Were around before this thing happened, but they really kind of caught, you know, they had a sail kind of raised when this wind was moving. Organizations like, you know, the Gospel Coalition and conferences like T4G and all that sort of thing. We can troubleshoot like what happened there. Yeah. And I think it's not a monocausal thing. I think there's like multiple sort of stressors that led to a kind of a fracturing there. And a lot of it is, I think, related to social media and democratization of media where people can have their own platforms, their own sort of, and there's, you know, positives to that. Obviously we all get a voice kind of thing, but it also led all these like multiple smaller deals to say like, well, we could be just like them. Right. Yeah. So they kind of broke off and created their own. So we all, you know, we kind of siloed off. Yeah. We all just sort of insulated ourselves. And so now you've got where there was together for the gospel.
Yeah.
The Lord scattered us in our, you know, confused our languages and and that tower has been toppled, right? Yeah. So now we have all these different sort of monuments to individual tastes. Well, here we've got the gospel plus we do this thing.
Yeah.
And, you know, so that kind of, you know, looks at, you know, what happened, I think, institutionally to the movement. Philosophically and spiritually, I think there's a number of things that have led us to kind of drift away. And one of the, you know, pressure points, I'll be honest to say, is I think the social justice conversation, when we had sort of rival voices coming in and how that kind of derailed our thinking in terms of the gospel. It became political, and you know, that influence there. And so some people were like, they made their platform less about the gospel and more about the implication on either side. So you had some that are like pro-social justice, you know, social justice is the gospel, and they took off down that track. Yeah. And then you have the others that are like, hey, we're anti that.
Yeah.
So they make their platform anti the social, you know, justice people.
Yeah.
Meanwhile, they're on this sort of, you know, horseshoe, you know, collision course, both sort of drifting away from the centrality of the good news.
I was really surprised that that's where you went actually in your book. So I've been able to have a sneak preview of Lest We Drift. And I was actually really surprised how you started on two fronts.
Okay.
Number one, I learned some things about you I did not know beforehand.
What did you learn about me that you didn't know?
Your connections with Mark Driscoll.
Oh, yeah.
I did not know.
Yeah, he's a buddy. We talk all the time.
Yeah, no, sure. but that was a surprise to me because I don't know in what I've read from your books just how much you necessarily divulge in terms of past working environments and things like that. So it felt very personal at the beginning. But then when you went into the social justice, I thought, oh, you're jumping right in the deep end then. I mean, I find myself agreeing with you. I was just really surprised that that's where you went to first. I think for me, it was a little unusual moving to the States, because in the UK, we were in some senses inheriting the social justice movement, because a lot of the issues were starting in the States. And then we were kind of inheriting that back into the UK. Now, obviously the UK has their social justice issues as well, but it was more at the peak. It was kind of coming from the States, and people in the UK were really kind of taking that mantra on. But to some senses, the churches sheltered themselves a little bit because they would say, oh, that's an American thing. That kind of came from the States. So we don't have to worry about that as much. Now, that's not necessarily true, but we were shielded a little bit from it. When we moved to the States, and this was kind of post a lot of things happening, man, I saw the big difference in churches, even just Christians that weren't really involved in it, just the comments they would make. And you're right that it was either on the, this is what it means to be a Christian. We must, you know, raise the voices of the marginalized and we'll stand behind them. And then almost like shockingly racist statements from Christians that you would love and know, basically because they're on the opposite side of you're missing what the gospel is. The gospel is this. Therefore, if the gospel is that, we must hate this social justice thing. And as you say, that pendulum was just significant. And it shocked me because it was from Christians that I would love and respect. And the whole conversations was on essentially how you would put your picture on Facebook or Twitter, as in what statement will you say, what life would matter, and how you would debate that. And it, as you say, we drifted into the debate on something that we then attached the gospel to. And I think that's still happening.
Yeah.
Maybe not to the same significance, but it's still happening even today.
Midwestern Seminary is pleased to announce the launch of FTC Talks. FTC Talks presents the opportunity to hear from Midwestern Seminary professors about their area of expertise and ask them any questions you want. It's completely online and it's free. We have an array of FTC Talks scheduled for the spring, including a talk on gospel-driven ministry with myself and Midwestern's preaching professor, Dr. Jared Bumpers. That's on March 26th at 12 p.m. What does the gospel have to do with pastoral ministry? Is there a particular way to pastor that is gospel-centered? In this FTC talk, Dr. Bumpers and myself will discuss gospel-centered ministry and everything from pastoral health and pastoral care to how to know when your ministry veers off track. Not only will you be equipped to minister the gospel from a place of health through this conversation, but you'll also receive personal encouragement from men who have practiced gospel-centered pastoral ministry for decades. We hope you'll join us for this special conversation. It's March 26th at 12 p.m. There'll also be a time for Q&A so we can interact with you. You can learn more about all of the FTC talks and sign up to participate in these free resources by going to mbts.edu/FTC talks. That's mbts.edu/FTC talks. Yeah, and not just there, you know, that's sort of a jumping off point for me. And the book is not about social justice or anti-social justice or anything like that. It's about how that conversation gives one little window into how drift can happen one way or the other, right? Where we can become so focused on the implications of the gospel, whatever you may think they are, that you lose sight of the gospel itself. This is something that D.A. Carson has written and taught about extensively. And I always sort of go back to the illustration that he gave once about how, generationally, like one generation assumes the gospel and then the next generation loses the gospel. So, it's up to the next then to recover it. Well, we've come out of a recovery stage and that we're now in this sort of assuming stage, well, of course, the gospel. And if that's where we are, then it's just one generation into losing that gospel. So what I do in the book is kind of work through five different dangers that can distract us or lead us to depart from the centrality of the gospel. What I'm doing in an overarching way is trying to just assert again, as I've tried to do in every book, really, the importance of gospel centrality. What is it? What are the implications of that? What are the tenets of gospel centrality? Because I think even the average person who even subscribes, I go to a gospel-centered church, I listen to Gospel Center podcasts, et cetera. The For the Church podcast is a gospel centered resource, right? If you ask them, what does it mean to be gospel centered? Yeah. I think we struggle in the same way that some people struggle with that, gospel amnesia question. So I try to, re-articulate, reassert what gospel centrality is, and then offer five different dangers. And I'll just give them briefly to you. The first is a drift into victimhood. I think a kind of martyr's complex, a kind of victimhood mentality across the board, I don't think there's one segment of evangelicalism that doesn't struggle with this, that it is a perplexing and constant sort of temptation for us to treat ourselves, whether it's because of the therapeutic influence in our culture or just the anger and the fear that is there in the political ideology, whatever it is, we see ourselves as victims. Secondly, a drift into dryness. So I just think a spiritual, this is, what we talked about at the very start of the podcast, why gospel amnesia? Well, we haven't made it personal. Yeah. It's not affecting us in a vital, intimate, spiritual way. It's an abstraction. It's a theology, but it's not a personal, applicational theology. And so there's a spiritual dryness, I think, that, can occur. A drift into superficiality. We just sort of play on the surface of Christianity. We use Christianity as sort of a cultural thing and not as a personal thing or a vital thing. It's just sort of we like Christian culture more than we like Christianity itself or more than we like Christ himself. So in a drift into superficiality, I talk about just the danger of neglecting intimacy with our Savior and making personal our faith. Fourthly, a drift into pragmatism. This is something, of course, I've written about for the last 10, 15 years. But I do think the spirit of pragmatism is one of the greatest dangers, if not the greatest danger, in distracting us from gospel centrality. And I don't think it's just the attractional churches that wrestle with this. Any church that is struggling with kind of the new legalism and moralistic sort of approaches, and attractional has now, there's 31 flavors of attractional now. It's not just the kind of Willow Creek, Andy Stanley kind of deal anymore. But I talk about that in that chapter as well, the kind of rise and the spread and the different variations of the attractional church in pragmatism. And then finally, fifthly, a drift into the new legalism. And so looking at kind of the rise, the resurgence of a kind of a fundamentalist culture or fundamentalist spirit that, again, I think affects all across the board. I think it's been astounding to see those who would fall kind of in the liberal wing of things, progressive wing of things, how narrow-minded and how stringent they are and how, even those, who claim to be pro-choice are very anti, freedom and anti-liberty and all these sorts of things. And you think, that's not even in the spirit of what you claim to be, right? Yeah. It's an illiberal liberalism. So I think even, the spirit of fundamentalism has affected left and right and all manners of the political and ideological spectrum. So in that chapter, I really just kind of go against both moralism and sort of the fundamentalist spirit, not necessarily fundamentalist theology, but the fundamentalist spirit. Things I like Carl F.H. Henry. There's nothing new, right? There's new expressions of this stuff, but you know, taking it back to the scriptures and taking back to church history, one of the things I try to do in the book is to say, like, hey, we've been through this before, you know, different iterations of this. Some of the expressions may be new because of the technology and the venues and the people and the personalities, but there's nothing new under the sun.
Yeah.
The Bible helps us with all of this. And so finally, what I try to do is give sort of a path forward, like what would it look like to reclaim gospel centrality in our churches and in evangelicalism?
A couple of questions for you that just from the kind of these chapters. There's a quote that I thought was interesting in the sense of, I think no one would be surprised by this quote, but I think it still continues to be an issue. This is a quote from the, I think it was the Pragmatism chapter. The church loses sight of the gospel when we trade in its spiritual powers for programs, formulas, and strategies, when we trust more readily for results. Basically trusting in what we do rather than what we're about.
Yeah.
That's such an obvious quote from you, I think. I think that's what we talk about quite a lot on, even on this podcast. Yes, why is it still a problem? If we know that programs don't really work, like if we're really honest with ourselves, sure, they might bring in people, but they don't really work. The formulas and strategies, man, there is tons of books out there about how to grow your church, how to develop your church, how to, you know, save souls, all these sorts of things. Yet we know they kind of all fall flat. Why do we still have that issue? Why is something so simple like you saying, yeah, we're losing sight of the gospel, actually not a normative view when it comes to book writing, when it comes to actually helping churches to grow? Why is it still a problem?
Yeah. Well, spiritually, I think it's because unlearning those things isn't a one-time process, for the same reason that we're talking about this concept of gospel drift or gospel amnesia, right? We wake up forgetful of this. Martin Luther once said that the job of the pastor is to know the gospel well and to beat it into the heads of his people continually. There's a reason why he would say, like, this is an ongoing deal, and he's drawing from, you know, I think even, you know, Jesus saying, if anyone wants to follow me, he must, you know, daily take up his cross, deny himself, right? So repentance is an ongoing process, and it's because we don't wake up in gospel mode. We have to press reset in some ways. We have to set our eyes, fix our eyes on Christ, and refix our eyes. And so I just think as a church, we drift into, you know, distrust because we naturally, or, you know, in the flesh, distrust that the Holy Spirit is actually the power to change people. And so there's nothing wrong with strategies, programs, you know, that's not my point, that you shouldn't have any of those things, but you shouldn't trust those things to do what only the gospel can do. And very often in our churches, we begin to put all of our trust, our weight, you know, of transformation into, oh, we finally have the silver bullet.
Yeah.
We've unlocked the thing. We've got the small group program that's going to change everything. And we forget that it's actually this message that Jesus Christ died on the cross and rose again from the grave, that that's actually the message that transforms hearts.
Yeah.
And there's just something, I think, because it makes so little of us that we just naturally don't lean into it.
Yeah.
And it's because it's the old, old story. I think sometimes we think, well, yeah, of course the gospel, right? And so we just take our eyes off of it. And just like when you're driving, you know, you drift towards what you're looking at. As soon as you take your eyes off, the longer your eyes are off the gospel, the more you're going to drift towards that thing that you're staring at.
I think when it comes to those programs, I think this is where you find it quite a lot is in revitalization, church revitalization, is when you start challenging, why do we even have these programs? Should we just stop these? You know, stop the mother and toddler group, stop the trunk or treat, and you'll get a reaction. And that reaction is, well, if we stop those things, the church isn't really doing anything. And it's this thought of, we've put our trust off what we do in these activities. And I'm just reminded of a Northern Irish church that we attended. They used to pray before every single event. So church service, there was a little prayer meeting beforehand, Wednesday night study, prayer meeting beforehand. And it was this consistent reminder that we can't go into doing anything unless we seek the power of the Spirit to do something in these programs. So it's kind of one of those things of, I guess we're saying, feel free to use programs, but use them rightly.
Yeah.
They are not going to do what you think they're going to do.
It's kind of the trellis and vine thing, right? Don't expect the trellis to be the vine.
Yes. Yeah. Absolutely. Another question I want to ask is about the element of preaching, and when it comes to the thought of legalism on paper or legalism in voice. And again, this is another quote. They may not be legalists on paper, but they appear so in the pulpit. So just want to kind of touch on that about you can have the strongest gospel-centered type individual, yet their preaching does not come through in that way. What does that look like? What does it sound like? Why does that happen?
Yeah. Well, it happens for the same reason the previous phenomenon happens. We distrust the gospel to actually change people. We think, oh, I've got to overemphasize this. I've got to really sort of shore it up with some, legal scaffolding here. Really cannot trust the Holy Spirit working through the fullest message of the cross to actually help people become more sanctified. And so we think we got to help it out. And what it looks like is kind of borderline scolding, sometimes just outright scolding, a kind of nagging about the law, an overemphasis of the legal implications in a text of scripture that you're preaching over against the the indicatives, the the gospel in the scriptures. The second tenet of gospel centrality, I kind of outlined three implications of gospel centrality or the essence of gospel centrality in three tenets. And the second is that people change by grace, not by law.
Mm-hmm.
And the law tells us what to do, but it can't empower us to do it.
Mm-hmm.
So the law is good. This isn't about embracing any kind of antinomianism or anything like that. But it doesn't empower us to obey itself. We need the good news, right? 1 Corinthians 15, Titus chapter 2, 2 Corinthians chapter 3, especially verse 18. These are all pointers to us, and there's more, that it's actually the grace of God that empowers us to obey and to delight in God's law. And so when we sort of weight the law heavier than the gospel, it's because we're trusting the law to do more than the gospel. And I think that comes out sometimes in demeanor and posture. Sinclair Ferguson's book, The Whole Christ, is really good on this.
Yeah.
It kind of delves into, of course, the Marrow controversy in historic Scotland, but the theological import for us today and the spiritual import for us today is to kind of look at how both antinomianism and legalism don't necessarily have to be the formal heresies. They can work themselves out in the kind of disposition of our ministries. And so somebody can be on paper, right, not a legalist, and yet in their preaching, you see their passion is way more excited about the law than it is the gospel. You know, the gospel's kind of like, oh, yeah, of course, it's there, or it's just kind of in the margins. But the law is what they're really excited about, and they start, they're fiery about about condemnation, and they're inspirational about, the exhortations. And you can just see from their demeanor, oh, that's sort of an informal kind of legalism. It's a legalistic spirit, if not a legalistic.
Yeah. And that feeds into them being legalistic even about how they share the gospel. I think we've both seen this online as well as in preaching, where you can deliver a gospel message, but it doesn't seem beautiful. It doesn't seem like your eyes are trained to Christ. It almost feels like you're quite literally bashing me with the gospel. And now I feel kind of ashamed that I don't like the gospel. And there's guys that can, even as you say in demeanor, as they tell the gospel, they almost seem angry as they're sharing the gospel. They're almost saying, rather than one thing I try to do in a lot of my preaching is to try and, to some extent, unlock beauty of what the gospel is.
Compassion.
And it's the, I love when Alistair Begg, that little video that Alistair Begg has about that, the man on the middle cross said that I could come. And it is that sense of unlocking that simple line, that simple beauty of it. I think a lot of preaching misses that. And I think that's part of kind of what you're hinting to as well is if you are not to the core, right back to that kind of gospel amnesia. If right to the core, you don't have that gospel of Christ really impacting your life, it's going to ooze out into how you preach and how you speak and how you travel and how you interact with people. You are going to have a different demeanor than someone that's really, truly gospel-centered. And you see that even amongst gospel centered guys. There's some guys that you just think, man, you really get this. You really live this. And it just impacts all of your life. So I wouldn't just say it's legalism potentially on paper. They're not legalistic on paper. I would say they potentially can end up being legalistic all the way through and not even realize it because they themselves have completely missed the beauty. It's the, I went camping last year, 2 years ago, I can't remember when it was. And I remember just sitting, looking at the mountainside and just all these kind of cars driving past, people getting about their life. They live there. They're used to it. They've got, they're no longer surprised by it. They no longer are seeing the beauty.
Yes.
And I think sometimes that's what's happening. We're unintentionally becoming legalistic because we're completely missing the beauty of what the gospel is. It's become too familiar for us.
Yeah.
Which is a kind of reminder for people that when we read your book, when you purchase a book, because that's what people should do, they should purchase your book, it shouldn't be treated legalistically. Oh, this means I must not drift. This means I must go and tell my pastor that he's drifting. This means that we have to do these things.
Yeah.
If anything, I guess a correct response to the book would be, am I seeing the beauty of Christ as if it was new every morning? Those blessings that are new every morning. Because that's the thing that's going to change. That's the thing that's going to impact ministry. Not, hey, Jared's given us 5 points. We should, you know, do this.
Well, I've already heard from a pastor friend who has ordered copies for his church staff. They're going to go through it together and kind of work through, hey, where are our, you know, maybe up to this point, undiscerned or undetected tendencies to drift in these areas? Are any of these departure dangers a danger to us, or, you know, which ones more so than others? And I think that's a good way to use the book. You know, it's not written, you know, purely for church leaders and for pastors. I think, you know, the lay person, I've always tried to write for the lay person to kind of discern the times, especially with this book, to kind of make sense of some of the cultural stuff going on that maybe they're like, hey, what's going on with this, you know, kind of conversation, or, you know, why does it seem like people are less interested, or what happened to the movement and those sorts of things. But I do hope that church leaders and you know, pastors and so forth will take a look at the book and find it helpful, not just culturally, but for their own church as well, particularly as I offer solutions. It's one thing to just do a big critique. It's another thing to say, hey, what's the response? What's the antidote to this? And I really wanted to do that in the book as well. The book is called Lest We Drift, 5 Departure Dangers from the One True Gospel, Lest We Drift. It's available now from Zondervan Reflective. I do hope that you'll pick it up. Let me know if you enjoyed the book, if it has helped you. One thing we also need to tell you about is Midwestern Seminary's Institute for Preaching and Preachers has a one-day workshop coming up on February 24th at the Trails Church in Salina, Texas. Salina, Texas? I'm not sure how you pronounce it. It's in the Dallas-Fort Worth area. We have a one-day workshop coming up. It's with myself, Matt Boswell, and Afshin Ziafat. We will spend the day working with you on biblical preaching, how to improve in your preaching, and there'll be some applicational hands-on time in groups to work through sort of a practical application of preaching as well. You can find out more about this event and register. There's a lunch involved as well. At preachingandpreachers.org. Go to preachingandpreachers.org to learn more about the Midwestern Institute for Preaching and Preachers and about multiple workshops that are coming up, including this one-day workshop on February 24th, that's a Monday, in the Dallas-Fort Worth area at Trails Church. As always, dear listener, if you enjoy the podcast, please give us a good review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, wherever you listen to your favorite podcast. And until next time, may Jesus be big in your church.
You've been listening to the For the Church podcast, hosted by Jared Wilson, found online at ftc.co. This resource is brought to you by Midwestern Baptist Theological Seminary in Kansas City, Missouri, where we train leaders for the church.